We are 6.5 minutes away from the drill known as the Great Shakeout, in which thousands of schools are taking part, people in businesses as well, and joining me to talk about the significance of this exercise on the 30th anniversary of the devastating Loma Prieta earthquake in the San Francisco Bay Area is Jacob Margolis, science reporter here at KPCC and the host of the very popular podcast, The Big One. Jacob, good to have you with us again.
Hey, Larry. How's it going?
Good. You know, when they started the Great Shakeout, I was a little skeptical. Because there's, you know, just so much talk about earthquake preparedness, and you know, many folks don't actually do a lot to prepare for it. This has really taken off on a life of its own.
Yeah, I think it's actually nationwide now at this point, right? There are a series of different kinds of shakeouts that basically people perform across the nation, and it's a big deal because we live with this threat all the time. This is there. A big earthquake is coming. It's just people don't usually think about it. And this is a good way to remind people and get them to actually act out some of the stuff that we need them to do.
All right. Very good. And in fact, if you want to share something that you're doing special this year for the Great Shakeout, you can call us at 866-893-KPECC at the school where my wife is a speech pathologist. Every year, they participate, like schools all over Southern California, 866-888-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Well, in light of today's Great Shakeout, the state of California has a big announcement and goes into effect in less than an hour.
Yeah, they're announcing an earthquake early warning system that is going to be statewide. We've had it here in LA County for, I think, since last January or so. And this is going to basically be a system that is available to people at any quarter of the state. It comes from from Berkeley Seismology Lab, USGS, Caltech has been a partner, and they're making a big announcement. So it should be a really important thing for Californians because with the LA app and with what we've been experiencing around here, as soon as you go outside LA County, it's not necessarily effective. So this is good that this is statewide.
Do you know how many downloads the LA app has had? Do you know if it's particularly popular?
I don't know, but I was looking at this new app, which people should know the name of. It's called MyShake. And I was looking at it this morning. I'm looking at it actually right now. And so far, there are 411,000 registered phones that are contributing to the app. And the app's really interesting because it actually uses I have an iPhone, so it uses the iPhone's accelerometer to actually also record the data of movement from people's phones all over the place as well. And it also utilizes, obviously, this extensive backbone, this network that USGS has been building out along faults throughout the state.
If you have questions for Jacob about the rollout of this brand new MyShake statewide earthquake alert system, we're at 866-893-KPECC. And again, if you are participating in the Great Shakeout, I'd like to hear about your experiences, maybe what you've learned from conducting the drill as a part of it that you hadn't known earlier. 866-893-5722. And so there are two different alerts, mm-hmm. Jacob. There is this MyShake, and then there's also what's essentially an Amber alert.
Yeah, the same system that pushes out the Amber alerts will push out alerts to phones when some level of shaking is detected. And the way that it works is basically a fault starts to slip. P waves are the primary waves, which don't create a lot of shaking, are detected by the sensors. They then can send out faster than all these waves are actually released by the fault. Faster than the shaking can actually come out, it can send that communication to people and say, hey, we know big shaking is going to come. If you have the app, you'll get some sort of notification. If you don't, it'll pop up like the Amber Alert would. And with the app, it uses your location, obviously, on your phone. With this Amber Alert system, it actually kind of triangulates you based off where you are in relation to cell phone towers.
All right. One of the things with the LA Shake Alert, it changed. Originally, mm-hmm. it was designed to be if you were going to be experiencing severe shaking, where it's likely that mm-hmm. there would be some sort of damage or potential injuries. But when the Ridgecrest quakes happened and that wasn't sufficient to trigger the LA County alert, people complained because they wanted to know if they were going to feel it, not whether it was potentially going to cause harm. So now the LA alert has changed, Jacob. And what is the thought? Is that because to me, there's definite downside of doing that.
Yeah, you don't want to desensitize people to alert. Look, we're very seismically active here. There are a lot of earthquakes happening all the time. But when people start to feel movement, significant movement, like they did with Ridgecrest, they want to know that that's coming just because they got scared. And the backbone of the system did work. It did pick up Ridgecrest. It just was the intensity wasn't set at the level that most people wanted. LA adjusted very quickly. And my understanding is that this new app also goes off of that level that they basically set.
So when you get an alert now, it's not going to mean that this is necessarily going to be causing damage or injuries. It just means you're going to feel it.
Yeah, and I know I would have liked a heads up by the time the 7.1 got to us that night. I don't know if you felt that way, but I definitely did.
Yeah, I felt some, because to me it was the opposite. Mm-hmm. When I didn't get the alert, I thought, okay, good. It wasn't felt in LA County to the extent that there wasn't. So I took that as some solace that I didn't get the alert. All right, we are coming up on the Great Shakeout 1017. That is because of the Loma Prieta earthquake, 30th anniversary of that quake. We are 10 seconds away from the Great Shakeout. And, I just got a false alert on my
phone. Are we going under the desk?
We are. Okay. So I'm feeling imaginary shaking. I don't know about you, Jacob.
Yeah, I'm feeling imaginary shaking,
I'm
too.
Feeling the imaginary shaking. So let's
you
get under the
drop
desk.
Cover
and
hold on.
Go. And yeah, get under. All right. It's easing up. Okay. It's good. I don't think anyone was hurt. So that's a very positive thing.
Yeah. I mean, we'd be hopping on the radio talking about it.
That's
right now,
it. And we have a backup generator also should we lose power so that we would be able to stay on the air. The question for many radio stations in the event of a major quake is, would the transmitters still have power that the signal would be able to get out, or would they have to, come up with some sort of a contraption at their studios to at least get some sort of signal out?
Yeah, and for people that aren't obviously at radio stations, it's really important that you get all of your emergency kit stuff together. And if we could do a quick overview.
Yeah, Let's do it.
1 gallon of water per person per day. I'm prepped for 2 weeks. You should prep for at least a couple days until emergency services come in. Have some food. Make sure if you need medicine, you have extra medicine. And if that needs to be refrigerated, you should probably have a little generator for a little refrigerator so that you can keep it refrigerated. Besides that, you need to work out some sort of emergency system with friends and family because cell networks might be down. I know we've been talking a little bit about this on the air, but it's always good to remind people.
And you have much of this information in the Big One, the podcast that you host as well.
Yeah, and if you go to kpcc.org/thebigone, we have that information up there.
All right, and LAist also has plenty of content
LAist as well.
About earthquake prep. We're talking with Jacob Margolis, KPCC science reporter and the host of the podcast, The Big One, which has also an addendum to it, post Ridgecrest earthquakes. Is that right, Jacob?
Yeah, it was important to talk about the Ridgecrest quake. And Ridgecrest is actually it was a really interesting quake in that it came from like this very complex system of faults up there. And so since then, there's actually a new study that just came out that talks about that I think you guys are going to be getting.
I'm glad you brought that
up
because coming up next hour, the embargo was lifted on that and we're going to have it. That's coming up later on. So
yeah, thank you.
All right. All right. So that's coming up on Air Talk here on 89.3 KPCC. We're talking with Jacob Margolis. So, Jacob, let's go back and talk about this system. So people download the app. Is there any problem with having both the LA County or LA City app, I should say, and the state app?
No, I mean, you're going to have some level of redundant alerts, possibly. The thing about the LA app that is cool is that there's a map of shelters, for instance, that people can actually, so it helps you beyond just kind of heads up an earthquake is coming. Like I said, the MyShake app is it's very sciencey when you look at it because of that accelerometer, that utilization of that accelerometer on your phone that kind of like documents the shaking across the area. The MyShake app does look a little better than the Shake Alert LA app, but they're going to continue the Shake Alert LA app development, according to Eric Garcetti. He said he's going to have both on his phone, and so it's, everything.
Well, if it's good enough
helps.
For the man.
Yeah, of course.
TJ in Atwater Village was wondering if the app has the intensity and the location right away.
If the MyShake app?
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it takes a little bit for the system to really figure all that stuff out. And oftentimes things change further out we get from the actual shaking and the alert. But it'll tell you heavy, big shaking is coming. And
well, in fact, if you sign up for the USGS alerts, which many of us get, you'll see those get modified. Sometimes even twice after a quake, they'll come up with recalculations of particularly the magnitude of the quake. Jacob, thank you so much. Appreciate your being with us.
Thanks, Larry.
During our great shakeout during this hour. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Boy, I appreciate your support of the program in so many ways. You're such a kind and generous audience, and what you do to support us just means a great, great deal. We turn our attention to a local controversy. This is the planned development in Inglewood for a new arena that would be a home for the Los Angeles Clippers. Steve Ballmer, who's the owner of the Clippers, wants to have his own place to play. They currently share Staples Center with the Lakers and the Los Angeles Kings, not to mention concerts and other big events. And the Clippers have third choice on the dates at the arena. That means that they play a lot of weekend afternoon games, less than prime time, because the Lakers and the Kings get the top choice of dates. Also, the Lakers have banners up along the rim of the ceiling there of Staples Center that the Clippers have to cover up to make it their own. There's even a separate lighting array that the Lakers use to create almost that kind of boxing match. High-intensity lighting on the court with the dimming of the audience lights. The Clippers play with the audience lights on at Staples Center. So Ballmer wants to have an arena that creates the Clippers' own vibe, their own sense of identity out from the shadow of the Lakers. And obviously, the city of Inglewood wants this a lot because of the financial incentives that are going to go in this community benefits package that Ballmer has proposed. It's $100 million, according to the team's valuation, that would go into supporting a variety of programs in the city of Inglewood. But the pushback is largely coming from the owners of the Forum, Madison Square Garden, that New York-based entertainment and venue operating company based in New York. They own and operate the Forum in Inglewood, which is a concert venue. They don't want to have to compete with a brand new Clippers arena that's just a short distance away. So you've got dueling public relations campaigns, dueling lawsuits that are going on. Residents are choosing sides in it. We were scheduled to talk with the mayor of Inglewood, Mayor Butts, who unfortunately just dropped out seconds before we began this segment and is not able to join us. Mayor James T. Butts Jr. of Inglewood to talk about in support of the project. The reason we're paying attention to it today is because two legislators who represent the Inglewood area have sent a letter to the California Air Resources Board claiming that racism is behind the board's length of time it's taking to consider what the carbon footprint of the new arena would be. The complaint centers on the fact that it took far less time for the Golden State Warriors' new arena in San Francisco to receive support from the State Air Resources Board, just over 2 months. But according to State Senator Stephen Bradford and Assembly Member Sidney Kamlager-Dove, it's taken months longer on the Inglewood project, and they wonder if it's because it's largely a community of color, where around the San Francisco brand new arena that just opened this month, it's largely white residents. Joining us to talk about the State Air Resources Board and the length of time involved in the process is David Pettit, who's senior attorney at the Natural Resources Defense Council. He's on their climate and clean energy program, and he's been working on the Clippers Arena project for the NRDC. David, thank you very much for being with us. I have a statement from CARB, a letter that they wrote back to the legislators. I'll excerpt in a moment, but what do you think about the amount of time they're taking?
Good morning, Larry, and thanks for having me on. It is taking more time than CARB took for some of the other projects. And my explanation for that is that the documentation that the Clippers sent them in order to get the special legal benefits that they want for this project is so flaky that CARB has had a tough time figuring it out. And in fact, CARB went back to the Clippers and said, hey, you know, we can't really understand this. Would you submit some more information to us and try to clear it up? The Clippers did that, but it's still pretty flaky, in my opinion. And I think that's largely what's leading to the unfortunate time lapse here.
And why do you have any theories on why their proposal isn't as concrete as CARB would like?
Yes, I do, because to meet the standards of the bill that gave the Clippers some procedural speed ups, the bill had AB 987 had certain standards in it. One of those was that the whole project needed to be net neutral for GHGs and
greenhouse gas emissions.
Greenhouse gases, yes. And in trying to show that the project would be, the Clippers made some pretty crazy assumptions. And that that I had trouble buying, and I think CARB is having trouble buying as well. And I think that's what's holding it up is a dispute about whether the assumptions that went into the modeling that the Clippers provided to CARB make any sense or not.
We're talking with the Natural Resources Defense Council Senior Attorney David Pettit. I'd like to hear from you if you're someone who lives in the greater Inglewood area and would be affected by the Clippers' new arena. They've offered significant financial incentives to the city of Inglewood, where the council is very excited about this new project coming in. They're looking at potential jobs and economic benefits. The Forum and its owners, Madison Square Garden, sees this as a detriment. And as I understand it, but I welcome your calls, it seems residents are somewhat split. There is a serious concern about gentrification. With a project like this going in, what it's going to do to the values of rental property, to home values in the area, and that might price longtime residents out of what has been a largely working class community. That is a significant concern of some residents that the incentives are great, but we may lose the place where we live. For others, they're looking at the potential investment in the city as creating more affordable housing is providing more opportunities. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I'm going to selectively read from Mary Nichols' letter. She's the chair of the State Air Resources Board. I can't read the whole thing. It's two pages. But what I think are some of the major issues that she raises. This was a letter sent in response to the complaint by Senators Stephen Bradford and Assemblywoman Sydney Kamlaker Dove. And Mary Nichols writes, just as we heard from David Pettit, that Assembly Bill 987 requires that the project does not result in any net additional emission of greenhouse gases, including from employee transportation. She says, in no time during the evaluation of this project has CARB or any of our staff attempted to delay or ignore or otherwise do anything but ensure the project will in fact not result in any net additional greenhouse gas emissions. Said we will endeavor to complete our review of that revised application. This is the one David was just mentioning that was turned in by June, the follow-up when CARB said that the first application didn't have enough specifics in it to make an informed judgment about whether it is a zero greenhouse gas impact. So within 120 days of the June submittal, they intend to come back with a response. Also, Mary Nichols says that CARB representatives for several months have been meeting with the developers of the Inglewood basketball project to try and work with them. Says these important benefits, Nichols writes, cannot come at the expense of increased greenhouse gas emissions at a time when our state is doing everything we can to cut climate forcing pollution. AB 987 directs no less than half of the required greenhouse gas emission reductions come from, quote, local direct measures such as expanding public transit, replacing buses and other public service vehicles with zero emission alternatives, and expanding energy efficiency in buildings in the community. David, can you elaborate a bit on what that means?
Yes, I'm happy to, Larry. And that's really the heart of our problem with what the Clippers have submitted. This greenhouse gas stuff, it's not just some academic exercise. When you mitigate or you try to make up for greenhouse gas emissions, in our view, the preferable way is to do that locally. For example, you could increase local transit. You can weatherize local homes, which can also lead to additional jobs in the community. You can have more bike lanes. You can have more electric charging available to the community. You can have EV chargers in the community. So there's lots of local measures that can be taken to sort of even out the GHG emissions from the project. And the application takes the position that they don't need to do any of that, as in none, because they claim there won't be any net increase in GHGs.
All right, we're talking with David Pettit of the NRDC, senior attorney on the Climate and Clean Energy Program. He's been working on the Clippers Arena project planned for Inglewood for the NRDC. I would like to hear from Inglewood area residents. You don't have to live directly in Inglewood, although, of course, Inglewood residents' voices are the most important because the spending that would go into the community from the project and the most direct effects would be felt by Inglewood residents. But if you live in the area, adjacent communities of South Los Angeles, Gardena, other communities, Westchester, that are fairly close and would feel some degree of impact, I'd like to hear what you think about the new proposed Inglewood Arena. We'll also read from the statement that the owners of the Forum Madison Square Garden have put out. And again, we had Mayor Butts of Inglewood scheduled to join us. He dropped out literally seconds before we were going to talk with him. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. Good to have you with us. We're talking about the ongoing controversy over the Los Angeles Clippers NBA team, their plans to develop and open a new arena in Inglewood, which would give them their own place to play, create their own culture and experience inside an arena that they don't have to share with the Lakers and Kings, as well as concerts and other dates where they wouldn't be the third choice on their playing dates as they currently are at Staples, and where they wouldn't have to cover up the Lakers championship banners and retired jerseys and all the other stuff in the rafters of Staples Center. But there is controversy, even as the Clippers are offering a package they value at $100 million to the city for a variety of mitigations and job training and housing projects and all sorts of things. Madison Square Garden, which owns the Forum and would be a potential concert competitor for the new arena, they have issued a statement. We want to be clear. We would not be against the Clippers building anywhere else in the LA market, which would still be competition for us. What we oppose is them locating their venue next to a football stadium and the Forum, right next to a residential neighborhood and on land that was taken through fraud and in violation of our deal with Inglewood. Jamming three large-scale venues within a mile of each other would ruin the experience for all event attendees and overwhelm Inglewood through crippling traffic and completely insufficient parking, increasing pollution, and decreasing the quality of life for the surrounding community. That's the statement from Madison Square Garden Company, which owns the Forum. Now, I asked for Inglewood area residents to share what you see as the pros and cons of the Clippers' proposed arena. Let's talk with Brett in Inglewood. Brett, what do you see from this?
Hi, Larry. Congratulations, first of all, and good luck with your fundraiser.
Thank you.
I've lived in Inglewood since 2014 and moved here for graduate school from Nashville, which also got an NFL team. And I bought a house in Inglewood, and I've seen lots of changes. So at the end of the day, I think it's a double-edged sword. I mean, the positives clearly are for landowners, or from property owners, but I do not support the crazy rent increases that I've seen at the local hearings. I mean, some people's rents being tripled. It's ridiculous.
You think that there's a way to avoid that happening at the same time that such a huge project is coming in, and there'll be development around that, and it'll be considered a more desirable place to play, pending the traffic effects. But how do you mitigate the increases?
I don't know that we can. I mean, we can put rent control in place like Santa Monica's done, and it will help. I mean, I saw it happen in Nashville downtown when the Tennessee Titans moved there in the 90s, and the land prices around town or downtown got really high, and so did the rent. So rent control is one way to do it, but I think Mayor Garcetti's already enacted something, and Inglewood's trying to make it retroactive, which will help. The people that are living there already. But it's a big deal. I mean, and also I've seen a lot of the mom and pop taco places and coffee shops close up, and the land's being taken over by franchises like
All right.
IHOP and Starbucks, which. And I go to those places. But.
Yeah. And it's not a surprise, even with a football stadium. And I'm sure with the revival of the Forum from Madison Square Garden, all of these individually have had, I expect, a significant effect. I mean, Inglewood's a great city. It's in a terrific location. It's got a wonderful climate. It's accessible to the airport. I spent, my early years growing up attending Inglewood Public Schools until junior high. And, it's a terrific community. Let me bring in Inglewood resident D'Artagnan. Thank you, D'Artagnan, for being with us. Now, you are on the school board, I understand. What do you see as the pros and cons of the Clippers Arena?
That's right. Thank you, Larry, for having me on the show. So, one of the things that we've continued to face here in the city is, as Brent pointed out, rising rents and the cost of living. But we're also seeing that impact our enrollment as families are having to leave because they're no longer able to afford to live here. In addition, where they're talking about proposing this arena, it's in people's backyards, right? So we're talking about millions more cars that are going to be coming down the road. We're talking about increased pollution, increased traffic, environmental impacts that in many ways are going to be difficult to be mitigated. And frankly, it's been unfortunate. So although the city announced this community benefits package, we have not seen that be real. There's nothing in writing. There are no guarantees. There is nothing really that has come out to suggest that the impacts of this arena and the football stadium are going to be mitigated by the developers or by the Clippers or any of the owners.
And do you see, setting aside those concerns from, do you see positives in terms of, potential jobs and tax revenue that in any way would counterbalance that?
I think there's always an opportunity to bring in good, decent paying jobs, at least for our friends in the trades. But the challenge is that the types of jobs that are left in our community once the construction is completed are typically low wage jobs, right? They're not prevailing wage. They are retail jobs that people can't even afford, where the pay they receive doesn't even allow them to pay rent in this city. So even though we may see all these benefits associated with construction during the sort of development period, we're not going to see those benefits affect community members and residents post the completion of the stadium, right? And that's the fundamental challenge. How will Inglewood residents get to benefit from all of this development? And unfortunately, I don't think our city has really honed in on how to best do that.
Well, I assume that there would be a fair number of employees, at least, during game days. Many of those people work other full-time jobs. They supplement their income working stadium events, Dodger Stadium and the Forum and elsewhere. So, there might be some jobs that would come out of that. D'Artagnan, thank you very much for being with us. Let me bring into the conversation Katie in Koreatown. Katie, you're an attorney with Public Counsel. You represent some of the residents there. What's the legal action you're taking?
Yes, good morning, Larry. Thank you for having me. I am an attorney with Public Counsel, and we represent the Uplift Inglewood Coalition. It's a group of residents and nonprofits and faith leaders in the city of Inglewood. And our lawsuit is really about holding the city accountable to the state affordable housing laws. So as you've talked about a lot on your program, we are seeing a severe housing crisis. And as was mentioned by both Brett and D'Artagnan, rents are increasing drastically. There was recently an article talking about the dramatic rise in property prices and rents in the city, the highest in the South Bay. And the city is turning their back on Inglewood residents by failing to properly implement affordable housing laws. So, for example, the arena, the Clippers arena that's being proposed is being proposed for public land. The Clippers are planning on buying land that is owned by the city, and the city is planning on giving them that land without first offering it to affordable housing developers, as they are required to under state law.
All right. Katie, I appreciate it. Thank you. Also want to thank David Bettett, a senior attorney on climate and clean energy program at the NRDC. Now, we approached the Clippers for them to talk about the project, but we've not yet heard a response from them. And we were scheduled to have the mayor of Inglewood, James Butts Jr., join us at the top of the show. And unfortunately, he dropped just seconds before we were ready to bring him onto the program live. So we hope that at some point, Mayor Butts, a representative from the Clippers as well, can join us to talk about the project. Lorena in Inglewood says, my brother is a senior. His rent has tripled in Inglewood. Inglewood used to be of the people, according to Lorena, but gentrification is kicking residents out. You can share your comments about the proposed Clippers Arena in Inglewood, where two state legislators are accusing the California Air Resources Board of racism because Inglewood is a working class community. It's taking much longer for environmental review of the Clippers Arena than the Warriors Arena in San Francisco. Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, a proposed $30 an hour minimum wage for ride-hailing service drivers. What would that mean for the fares? And would you be willing to pay the higher fares so that drivers would be able to make $30 an hour? We'll talk about that and get a sense of how price-sensitive Uber and Lyft riders are. But right now, we turn our attention to a brand new study that was conducted in the wake of the two earthquakes that jolted the Ridgecrest area on July 5th of this year. The new study from Caltech scientists is published in the journal Science. It looks at the origin of the quakes and discovers that multiple smaller faults were responsible for the 7.1 tremor and the 6.4 earthquakes. Thank you very much for joining us, Zachary Ross, assistant professor of geophysics at Caltech and the lead author on the study. So share with us what you were particularly looking at here.
Yeah, so we wanted to really figure out what happened during the sequence. And so we have all these recordings from different seismic instruments that are all around Southern California. We also have data from radar satellites that fly over the area. And so we can use that information to try to reconstruct the process that's happening in the seconds during the earthquake at the source itself. So we want to really understand that in much more detail.
And those sensors, are they even included on the China Lake Naval Weapons Station? Because I know that's got a lot of highly, you know, classified work there.
I believe there is one station at China Lake.
Okay. So you're able to take all that sensor data, satellite imagery, all these others, and then what are the questions you're trying to answer with that data?
So, yeah, that's a great question. I mean, one of the things that we want to know is how the earthquake rupture process unfolded. And so we wanted to see kind of how fast the rupture is propagating, what the fault structures look like below the surface. And so this study, we were able to kind of reconstruct not just the process for the large event, the magnitude 7.1, but also for the magnitude 6.4 foreshock as well. And so one of the key findings of this work was that in contrast to the way that we typically think about earthquakes, where they happen on one big fault that might be kind of almost infinitely long, like the San Andreas, mm-hmm. here we found out that this set of events was produced by a collection of smaller faults. In total, there's probably more than 20 of them that together produced this one large event.
And I assume they're interconnecting. That was how they produced the event?
Exactly. So you can think of this as kind of each one of these falling like dominoes in the seconds while this earthquake is actually happening.
So those smaller faults can behave like a larger fault when they fall like dominoes.
Yeah, exactly. So each one of these different faults might only add up to something like a magnitude 6 or smaller, but together, if they're all failing at the same time, they can produce a very damaging earthquake like this.
Now, we've known that you could have along a larger fault some sort of a slip, and that would have an effect on adjacent fault, that transference of energy. What's different about the finding here with these little faults that are interconnected?
So, you know, we know that earthquakes, as you say, can trigger earthquakes on other faults. What's surprising here to me is now really how often we're starting to see this kind of behavior. The classical model, as you talked about, it's kind of a single fault where the rupture propagates along this fault, and that's responsible for the earthquake. But starting around 30 years ago in 1992, when we had the big Landers earthquake, we've started to see, as our resolution has gotten better, that we're increasingly seeing more and more faults involved in these large earthquakes. And so I think now it's starting to look like this is actually happening most of the time.
When there were geological digs to look for historic evidence of earthquakes, was there any way to detect this previously? Or because you're looking at a specific slice deep in the ground, would that not necessarily tell you about these intersections and other faults that were moving at the same time?
So actually, this whole fault network, which is about, it's more than 50 miles long in total, the whole thing was unmapped. Some of these probably don't reach the surface at all, which would make them very difficult to identify, even with geologic trenching and things like that. I think to some degree, it's going to force us to think hard about whether we need to redefine how faults are characterized, because it's not just an individual structure that we're trying to identify. It's really thinking of them as kind of a volume of structures.
It's a network.
It's a network, yeah.
And if we don't know where all of those smaller faults are, then if there's no surface evidence, we don't have any previous quakes in recorded history, then now are there any new technologies that would help us discover those faults aside from producing a quake?
There are some new technologies that can help us, but we have to kind of ask the question of whether it's really even feasible to identify all of them in the first place. You don't need a very big fault to produce an event even magnitude 6. That's only a few kilometers long, maybe 5 kilometers or so. That's not that big. So, and certainly the ones that don't come near the surface, if they're only, many miles below and they stop before reaching the surface, we're probably never going to be able to find all of those. So we really need to think about whether there are other ways to basically characterize the full hazard potential in a region. Because if we look back now over the last century, and we think about all the damaging earthquakes that California has experienced, nearly every large magnitude event probably looks more like Ridgecrest than it does to the 1906 San Andreas earthquake.
Wow. So the implications, if I'm understanding you, are pretty significant, because it means the threats that we've talked about, largely based on these larger faults, whether it's, the Newport Inglewood or, even these regional ones that we know well what they can do from the Long Beach earthquake and other earthquakes, that the threat is even greater because we don't really have a handle on these interrelated smaller faults.
So I think that we've paid a lot of attention to the handful of really big faults throughout California, San Andreas, San Jacinto, and many others, as you mentioned, the Hayward Fault up in Northern California.
Puente Hills.
Yeah, sure. And those are still obviously very dangerous structures. But I think that, what we've been seeing over and over again and what we can probably expect over the coming century is that we're gonna see many large events that are not from these big structures. They're produced by smaller ones that work together.
And we thought they'd be highly localized. There's a fault that's right near our studios here in Pasadena. But my thinking about it has always been, this would, even though it's capable of producing a quake, you would feel that it wouldn't necessarily connect up to other quakes because it's not that
big a fault. But what you're indicating is it's entirely possible these, you know, highly localized faults could interconnect.
Absolutely. That's exactly what we're saying.
All right. If you have questions for our guest, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Caltech Assistant Professor of Geophysics, Zachary Ross, our guest. He's lead author of this study that was just released minutes ago, published in the journal Science. It details how the activity on these smaller faults in the Ridgecrest area interrelated and caused those two large earthquakes, the foreshock of 6.4 and the primary earthquake a day later of 7.1. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. What kind of effect do you think this finding has on the science of earthquakes?
So on the science side, I think it's going to ultimately force us to think about how we can incorporate these types of more complicated scenarios into our thinking and regularly doing so, but whether that means models that account for this kind of complexity that we're observing, not just a single fault that's nice and smooth. It could be very complicated, rough, overlapping with other faults and things like that. The field has kind of slowly been moving into this direction over the years as we've been observing this more and more. But I think that we really need to think about this as a very regular type of process, and that our science needs to reflect that persistently.
One thing we should mention is, we're talking about real briefly, we have like half a minute, the Garlock Fault, which was the fault known in this area, the Ridgecrest. What effect did this quake have on that fault?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So this sequence, the rupture of the main shock, the magnitude 7.1, terminated only about 2 or 3 kilometers away from the Garlock Fault.
Wow.
So Garlock is a huge structure in the region. It's about, you know, 180 miles long or so. And it produced its last large earthquake something like 500 years ago. What we saw following Ridgecrest was that it actually triggered Garlock to start creeping, which is basically a slow sliding. And it started sliding enough that it was observed by the radar satellites flying over to basically slide on the order of 2 centimeters across a very large area.
All right. Thank you, Zachary. Appreciate your being with us. Caltech, Zachary Ross on Air Talk. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We appreciate your support very, very deeply here on KPECC. Los Angeles City Council members, including President Herb Wesson, are proposing creating a $30 an hour minimum wage for Uber and Lyft drivers. 15 would be a technical minimum pay. The other 15 would go toward the expenses of operating their personal vehicles, maintenance, gasoline, wear and tear, other expenses. Council members want to have an independent study look into what the expenses are for drivers, as well as looking into what their average earnings are currently with ride-hailing apps like Lyft and Uber. The question is, if the city were to adopt this, what would the effect be on ridership overall? Because if fares go up considerably to be able to pay the higher wages and maintenance costs, would that potentially decrease the number of people using, and you'd have a significant cutback in drivers and in the number of riders that they would pick up? Joining us to talk about the proposal and what they think it would mean is Billy Binion, assistant editor for the libertarian-minded publication Reason Magazine. Billy, good to have you with us. What's your estimate of what the $30 an hour compensation and expense coverage would mean for the fares?
So we don't have an exact answer yet on, you know, just how much it would affect fares, just because this is kind of a new proposal. However, when California's AB5 bill came out, which essentially is now going to require that Uber and Lyft treat their drivers as employees, experts estimated increased labor costs would go up about 20 to 30%. So you could definitely see that reflected in fares. And unfortunately, I think it's important to point out that while these you know, these ideas are certainly well-intentioned. They often hurt the people who they're trying to help. Because what happens is when you do increase labor costs that much, you're going to trigger massive layoffs in ride sharing, which has essentially been this great gateway for anyone who is over 21 and has a car and is willing to work hard. You know, they can make some money. But it would make it kind of an exclusive profession, shutting out some of the more lower skilled, vulnerable populations that this legislation wants to help. And unfortunately, they would just kind of be out of luck. And then at the end of the day, fewer drivers means higher prices. There's really just no way around that.
You know, one of the aspects of it, though, that people could point to, that if this does raise fares 20% to 30%, it's that some of the lower income users of ride hailing services might turn to public transit, which has seen a huge drop off in people using it. So Uber and Lyft would be for people of means and public transit would be for lower income people. Would you see that as a positive or negative?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think that's kind of a classist response. I mean, I think that relegating people to public transit, which is historically very inefficient, is not the right solution. I mean, I think at the end of the day, when you have fewer drivers, what these apps do is they operate on something called surge pricing, right? So essentially, where the most populous areas are, drivers have an incentive to stick there because they're going to make more money, just supply and demand. So then, like you're saying, people who live kind of outside of those popular businessy areas, drivers aren't even going to want to come to them. And so it kind of reminds me of, you know, being a cabbie in New York City in the 90s, for instance, when they didn't want to go to poor areas because they just didn't want to deal with those people. I think Uber and Lyft and these ride sharing apps, Via, all of them, they really helped meet that need. And I think it would be a shame if we just kind of said, like, well, it's not for them anymore.
In New York City, my understanding is they put in higher compensation requirements for ride-hailing drivers. And there, I don't know that they've seen an appreciable drop-off in riding mileage or customers. So why was New York City able to sustain that?
Well, I mean, I don't know the particulars of New York City's proposal. I do know that Uber and Lyft, for instance, have really pushed back on some of these proposals in New York. For instance, in New York, 90% of app-based drivers are first-generation immigrant, which is kind of an amazing statistic that was released last year. And so if you essentially balloon the labor costs in these areas, you know, I don't think New York has done anything nearly as extreme as Los Angeles is proposing. You're taking a really vulnerable population that has this awesome opportunity and you're going to price a lot of them out of the market, and then they're just going to be out of luck. And then what are they supposed to do? I mean, maybe a choice few people are going to be able to stick with it, but certainly not all of them. And I think another important thing to point out is a lot of people use these rideshare apps to make some money on a flexible schedule. And Uber and Lyft have both said, if we implement really rigorous wage protections and, you know, and require that they are given benefits and pay time off, that kind of thing, then they're going to have to start scheduling them in shifts, because they're not going to be able to just like allow drivers to log on whenever they want, you know. And then, of course, I think a lot of drivers in that case would have a lot of time off, but it wouldn't be paid. It would be because they'd be unemployed.
We're talking with Billy Binion, assistant editor of the libertarian magazine Reason Magazine. Also joining us is James Hicks. He's a driver organizer with the gig workers group Rideshare Drivers United, based here in Los Angeles. He's been driving for ride hailing companies for 3 years. James, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I think certainly people understand why drivers ideally should be making more money, and that for many drivers, they're not seeing much out of this once they factor in the maintenance costs, the gasoline, all the other things that go with this. We've heard from many drivers who say this is just, you know, and they've dropped out because of that. Do you think that $30 an hour is sustainable, though, and that the increase in fares won't damage the industry overall?
I think it's absolutely sustainable. I think it's absolutely sustainable when you think about how much these companies are making from the total amount of drivers that are on the road. They spend a lot of money buying other app-based companies along the world, actually. They just spent $3 billion somewhere. So they have the money to make sure that we are paid a fair wage. And we don't even, in fact, I think New York, when you guys mentioned the fact that they had increased their fares, they had only had a drop off of about 1 to 2%. So people were still using them.
Do you know what the increase was there to accommodate?
Yeah, it was about 25%.
25% fare increase.
Yeah.
Okay. With a 1 to 2% decline in ridership.
Right. So New York has been really like a trial state, and we've been watching them very closely. And we think that the same thing is going to similarly happen here in California. But also, we're not exactly looking for customers to pay more. We are looking for Uber and Lyft to not be so greedy with the profits, that they would allow us to make a living wage. And, you know, the $30 an hour, it's a floor. It's not going to be a ceiling. This is 15 for wages, which is right aligned with Bernie Sanders and his fight for 15, you know, and other industries that are doing the same thing. So we're not asking for anything that is, I think, out of the realm of normality.
And just to clarify, so it's $15 an hour, as I understand it, which would be the minimum hourly compensation, $15 an hour on top of that, which would be for the maintenance costs.
Yes.
Have you done the math on the maintenance for your car?
Personally, I haven't, because I don't think I'm not good at math.
Okay.
But
have some of your members talked about what their costs are? I guess it so depends on how many hours you drive.
It depends on how many hours you drive. It depends on your vehicle. But I will say that we spend, we put about 3,000 miles on our car probably a month, you know, and that is gas, that's brakes, that's windshield wipers, that's windshield, that's everything that goes into the car that helps it run, you know, your transmission. You know, we, Lyft and Uber, they don't have a fleet cost, you know, they don't have a fleet cost. So we need the extra 15 just to keep the cars on the road.
And for yourself, because I know you're a driver as well, what's your average weekly number of hours that you're on the app?
It can be anywhere between, on the low end, it's 35. On the high end, it's north of 50.
Okay. So I assume that you are making money despite the costs.
I'm making some money, but the money that I should be making for the amount of work that I'm doing is not comparable.
Have you thought of leaving being a driver because of that?
Yes and no. I've been driving professionally maybe for about 10 years now. Back when I was in New York, I was doing delivery driving for a construction company. And when I came out to California, it was, you know, the easiest way to make good money. I've also thought about going back into the trucking industry, but I don't really want to drive nationwide. I want to come home every night. I want to spend time with my wife. I want to, you know, enjoy my life, you know, and not to say the truckers don't, but.
But they're trade-offs,
but,
definitely.
Yeah.
We're talking with driver James Hicks. He's also organizer with the gig workers group Rideshare Drivers United, based in Los Angeles. He's been a driver for 3 years with ride-hailing apps. I'd like to hear from you as a rider. If you're someone who's a fairly regular user of Lyft and Uber, I'd like to hear how much of a percentage increase you feel like you could take, and you'd still be using it just about as much as you are now. What would be the breaking point for you in increase? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Uber, by the way, scheduled to go public Friday. Its valuation could top $90 billion, that despite the fact that Uber is not profitable. It reported an operating loss of $3 billion last year. It lost $4 billion in 2017. But of course, people are betting on what they think will be its future profitability. Coming up, we'll talk with frequent AirTalk guest Harry Campbell. He's an LA-based Uber and Lyft driver and founder of therideshareguy.com. We'll continue in a moment. Yeah, I just want to correct. I misread something. Uber, of course, is publicly traded right now. But those financials that we gave you on the company were accurate for the past couple of years. We're talking about the future of Uber and Lyft. Drivers almost uniformly complain that their compensation is too low to both keep their vehicles up and operating safely and to compensate them for the hard work and stress of their jobs of driving all over Southern California. So Herb Wesson, the president of the LA City Council, and some of his colleagues are proposing $30 an hour of compensation and maintenance coverage for Uber and Lyft drivers. $15 an hour would be guaranteed as a minimum wage, even if people aren't transporting passengers during that full hour, and $15 an hour, which would go toward the maintenance of their vehicles. I'm asking you, if you are a user of Uber and Lyft, how much additional would you pay for a fare to use those ride-hailing companies? And what would be the threshold where you say it's too expensive, you wouldn't keep using it? 866-893-KPECC. Reed in Playa Vista says $30,000 a year in maintenance sounds unreasonable. He's going on $15 an hour in maintenance costs. He asks, is that really the cost? Does that include gas expenses? Let me bring into the conversation LA-based Uber and Lyft driver Harry Campbell, frequent Air Talk guest and founder of therideshareguy.com, a blog and podcast for drivers. Harry Campbell, good to have you with us again. Is $15 an hour really an accurate reflection of the maintenance costs?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Larry. And I do think that, you know, the first thing that came to my mind is $15 an hour seems a bit high. You know, as James mentioned earlier, this is a pretty complex calculation, though, and it does vary a lot for drivers. We've sort of studied it in the past and found that it typically is more in the $3 to $5 or $3 to $7 per hour range for expenses on the vehicle, and that includes everything from depreciation and maintenance to gas. But again, that really depends on your vehicle, and it's a pretty complex calculation. But I think, as in all good negotiations, right, you want to start a little bit high maybe and find a medium or a balance that's a little bit more based on the facts, and it seems like that's what the council is definitely open to.
And do you think, first of all, what do you think would be the likely increase in fares if the full $30 an hour ended up approved? Harry?
Yeah, so, I mean, we know that drivers right now, So we know that drivers right now make about $15 to $20 per hour before expenses. This has been something we've found in studies of thousands of drivers over the years, and some other independent surveys have also kind of come up with similar numbers. So I think if you look at it kind of from a simple basis, if rates go pay goes up 33%, I think fares would have to be reflected in a similar number. But as with any complex marketplace, I think what I want people to think about at least is what the unintended consequences might be, right? If fares do go up, kind of the questions you're asking listeners right now, would people start taking Uber and Lyft less? And probably they would, but would that kind of impact, or would that offset the increase? And I think the other thing to consider too is just, you know, as demand goes down from riders, if there's still the same number of drivers, that means that there's going to be less rides to go around. So that hourly rate might be a little tougher to achieve still.
Yeah. And given the complicated formula, and again, I understand why the people who, you know, follow your blog or listen to your podcast would say, you know, I'm not making it on the compensation, but, there also could be unintended consequences for this as well. And is this something that you're sort of entertaining this back and forth, Harry?
Yeah, and I think that I think that what James has mentioned and what Rideshare Drivers United are pushing for is really a great thing for drivers. I think that with Uber and Lyft kind of in full control of pricing, we're sort of seeing the negative effects, right, that they really are not paying drivers enough. I mean, 2/3 of all drivers quit after just 6 months, and that's from Uber's own study, that figure. So a lot of people aren't even making it past the first 6 months because the pay isn't enough. So I think with Uber and Lyft at the helm, the pay just hasn't been high enough. But at the same time, you know, I don't think we want to take a complete 180 and let drivers price themselves out of the market. I think we want to find a nice balance. If we look to New York City, which I think has done a great job starting some of these regulation talks and paying drivers an hourly minimum wage, you look and see some of the unintended consequences we're seeing there is that drivers are actually no longer allowed to log in whenever and wherever they want. If it's not busy, Uber and Lyft aren't letting drivers log in because kind of it might make sense to you. You know, they don't want to pay drivers to just sit there.
Sure. And would that be okay with you, Harry, as a driver, if that happened in L.A.?
Yeah, and I mean, this is actually, you know, something that drivers in New York City are protesting right now, but I think you have to understand that there are trade-offs. If you're going to require companies to pay a higher hourly wage, then you have to understand that they're not going to want you to log on in times where you're not going to get any trips. And I think that even though that does take away some of the flexibility, I do think it's kind of a good thing for drivers, even though they may not like it, because it's sort of forcing them or coaching them into better behavior. I mean, that's what my site is all about. It's about telling drivers when and where to drive so that you're most busy and do the most number of trips and make the most amount of money.
I just wonder if it ends up then favoring the full-time drivers as opposed to the ones who do it as a side gig. But James Hicks, what's your thought on this?
Yeah, so the way that I see it is that, sure, there might be some trade-offs. So what's happening in New York is actually is they are logging people off, not stopping them from getting on. They're logging people off automatically.
Because of too many drivers.
Because of too many drivers. But one way that they can combat that is to actually, they're hiring hundreds and hundreds of new drivers, you know, a day, a month. You know, they're just bringing them on. So if they stopped the hiring and had a hiring freeze, there's more than enough drivers to go around in L.A. And 90% of us who are doing the bulk of the work, we're the full-timers. And this is not to throw the part-timers under the bus, but, you know, the biggest problem I have with part-time work is the fact that somebody's main job is not paying them enough, a living wage, and they have to have that similar fight with their main job, which is the same thing that we're having with this job right here.
Well, pretty much anybody can use extra money, though.
Right.
I mean, if they've got
sure.
the time.
And
I mean, even middle-class folks
yeah.
drive
for Uber.
And
I don't
want
to stop people from doing it part-time. We want them to be protected as well, you know?
We're talking with James Hicks of Rideshare Drivers United, L.A.-based gig workers group. He's organizer with that organization. Let me go back to Billy Binion of Reason Magazine, the libertarian publication. Billy, one of the things that we've heard, and James articulated this and Harriet too, is, you know, this come up, the amount of compensation that goes to top executives of Uber and Lyft, acquisitions of other companies, all this investor money that has gone into those things versus into compensation to the drivers. And they say, you know, they should get that money, or at least part of it, instead of the execs and the acquisitions. Your response to that?
Yeah, so I think some of this is a bit of a myth. Uber CEO makes $45 million a year. There are 3 million Uber drivers. If we distributed that evenly, we could give them each an extra $15 a year. The idea that Uber is necessarily being greedy with profits is just not true. You mentioned that they lost money. Last year, they lost $2 billion. They're not solvent. And Lyft, on the other hand, is looking to get solvent. They're looking to essentially be 20% in the black. And in order to do that, you know, with a lot of these changes we're talking about, they are discussing investing in self-driving cars, which talk about pricing drivers out of the market. I mean, we would just be getting rid of them altogether, and I would hate to see that happen. They've also talked about cutting back pay incentives by about 20%. This is from the New York Times. Cutting back other incentives by 11%. It's
okay.
It hurts the people it's trying to help is kind of what I'm trying to get at here.
All right. Billy Binion of Reason, thank you very much. James Hicks, thank you for joining us from Rideshare Drivers United. And Harry Campbell is always the RideshareGuy.com, where you'll find his blog and his podcast. Jen in Sherman Oaks says, I rent a car from Lyft to drive. I agree $30 minimum is necessary. It costs so much between gas and insurance. I barely cover enough to rent the car. It's $1,000 a month. I calculate right now, I make about $8 an hour. That's Jen in Sherman Oaks. You can share your comments if you're a rider for Lyft or Uber, or if you're someone who uses either or both of the services. Share your thoughts about the proposed $30 an hour compensation for ride-hailing drivers. It's Air Talk.